Have I ruined life, bro? All right. Kia ora mai tātou. It's Kyle Burrows here from Haka in the Matrix. I'm just going to wait for a few people to come on, actually. We've got zero people watching right now. So I'm just going to give it a few seconds and we'll get started. Hey, here we go. All right, I'm going to start again. Kia ora mai tātou. This is Kyle Burrows. We're on Haka in the Matrix. I'm from Haka Works and I have a special guest with me today is Mr. Mark Tume. You can see him there. He's actually in isolation, just arrived over from Queensland. And so we're lucky to have him on board with us. He's actually a relation of mine, a whanaunga. He's from Ngāti Maru, from the same village as me up in Pūrangi, which is really quite remote. There's nobody really living there now. We've got a urupā and we've got a church. But we've just gone through a claim settlement with Ngāti Maru, and we have just had it ratified by our iwi, and our Pūrangi is one of our traditional papakāinga that we're looking forward to reinvigorating over the years. Excuse me. But more importantly, I've got Mark here because we want to talk about his role as a director. He's been on the boards of a number of really major companies in Australasia. And currently he is chair of Infratil, and also he's the chair of Ngaitahu Holdings and Te Atiawa Holdings Limited as well. So I'm really pleased to have him on board. We'd like you to stick around because we are going to be talking about the role of a director. What's the difference between being a director of a public company and Māori entities, Māori-owned private companies, and just the journey of Mark that he has taken to get to where he is at the moment. Excuse me. So a little bit about our show and just a quick mihi-mihi before we get started. So Haka in the Matrix, Haka is what we do. We started off performing Haka about 15, 16 years ago. We've been sharing Haka and sharing Māori culture. So Haka around the world as Haka Works. And so Haka is really a metaphor really for our culture and the tikanga that's been passed down to us that we share with others today. The reason why we share it is because we think we have a lot to offer as Māori with the rest of the world. And saying that, we also appreciate that we need to do so in a way which enhances who we are, enhances our culture. So there are some sort of restrictions around those which we'll be discussing over the months. It's really moved into talking to Māori business owners, managers, directors about how we can manage our organisations in a way which aligns with our own culture and some of the issues around that. And this is why we've got Mark here with us. If you're watching, do come and say hello. Drop a message and ask any questions of Mark. So we've got a mihi from my dad, first one to come in. So kia ora, Dad. Anaru Marshall, tēnā koe, Anaru. Ngāti Maru and Nathan Petty as well. Tēnā koe te whanaunga, tēnā koutou. So yeah, just drop your messages in there. So ka huri ki te mihi, tēnā koutou katoa, o ka rongo mai. Kia mātou, kia māua nei ko Mark i tēnei wā. Koutou rā ko tai mai rungi te kaupapa te wā. Ko te kaupapa, ko tēnei mea ko tātou nei, tikanga no o tātou tupuna. Me pēhia te tōhaina ki te ao, kia mau tonu ki te te rāhua tūturu o ngā tikanga ko tuku mai, kia mātou, kia tātou i tēnei wā. Ngā mate o te wā, haere. Haere, haere, rātou, tātou, kia tātou, kia ora mai tātou. So, ka huri ki a koe, Mark, tēnā koe, nei mahara mai, kia ora.
Kia ora, Carl, and morena to all of your listeners there in the UK. I don't think there are any listeners in the UK. I'd like to acknowledge Nathan for giving up their evening. And acknowledge also the role, the fabulous role that they've played, and yourself in getting the claim to where it is now. I've watched all of the clips that have been sent that have been on Facebook. So I've been following all of that, and you have done just an absolutely fantastic job, far better than my first attempt at that back in the 1990s.
Just wanted to say, you know, support you in what you're saying, and we've been through a long journey, both of us, in terms of Ngāti Maru, or all of us really, and it's really awesome to see it coming out to this point. And I want to talk about Ngāti Maru later on, but just tell us a bit about yourself, you know, tell us, because I don't have many relations, I suppose, that have got to the heights in terms of the corporate world as you have. So it's an opportunity for us to hear what sort of journey you went on to get to this point, and yeah, knowing that you're a Ngāti Maru boy.
Yeah, I really don't like, you know, the idea of heights. I think everyone, you know, has a role to play, and I look at the role that many of you've played in terms of progressing the claim, and I have to recognise that too as a fabulous achievement as well. So, you know, it's one of many achievements that that our whānau have been able to get through. But I think I'll start before the start, if you like. So so when I look at my whānau, and it's an amalgam of Pākehā New Zealanders who came out in some of the early boats in the 1890s, and Tūhara Toa, who through the colonisation period set up a marae down as far south, the very southernmost Te Tikanga, which is just out of Martin, and of course Ngāti Maru, who my great grandfather and grandfather worked the river. So when you look at the common thread there, how did I come to be in existence in Whanganui? Whanganui as a colonial town, if you like, was one of the earliest settled places in New Zealand, mainly because of the awa that flowed right up into Tuatahi Toa territory and up around there. It was Motua was a big trading area for, I found out recently, for Ngaitahu as well. They used to bring their waka up from the south to trade through Motua up into Tuatahi Toa as wow. well. So you know, in unpicking where am I from, it's been really interesting, and I found a lot about my Pākehā side of the family, because I worked in the cemetery in Whanganui, in the old cemetery, mowing the lawns and doing all that sort of thing. And you could come across the gravestones, and the gravestones there are a really fabulous history of a town. So you come across relatives of yours that have passed away, you know, poignant at the moment, because a lot of them got killed in the 1915 flu epidemic, which is interesting. So when I look at it, so my nan from Martin, and my koro was from up and down the river, and they kind of coalesced in Whanganui, and then my mother's side, they were some of the early settler families there as well, and I was born and brought up in Whanganui. You know, went to the local high school, did all that sort of carry on. And it's quite funny because my mum was, and my nan actually, were very, very keen on European education.
Yeah.
And it was quite interesting. I found out subsequent that my nan in particular was very keen to essentially keep us away from the marae to a certain extent, to get a fully assimilated European, if you like, education. Because she saw that as a pathway to success, I guess, and she was one of that generation that was beaten at school for speaking Māori, and you know had some really big scars from that period.
Yeah.
She sent Dad to Hatapaura, and that didn't really work out either in terms of all he wanted to do was get out of school and get down to the freezing works. And which he subsequently did, and so I think she and was looking for a reset, and that was something that my mum and dad as well were very keen, and Dad was especially keen to keep the priests away from the door to get them to send me to St. Augustine's or Hatapaura or any of those schools. And so we were definitely down the state school line. I don't think we could afford to go to any of those schools anyhow. So it was almost a deliberate act to hold us back from the Marae. Now, you roll on a few years. I got a couple of other interesting anecdotes, actually. I remember my mum coming home from school. I was in the fifth form, and Dad said, look, you don't need any more education past your 15. You know, you don't need any education past that, because once you're at 15, you're old enough to go out to work. It's sort of a classic working class attitude, if you like. So mum comes home from a parent-teacher's evening, and she says, hey, they want him to go back to school next year. They think he's got some brains. And I remember my dad was almost, he was, nah, when you're 15, you got to get out and work. You can't be messing around at school. And anyhow, she finally persuaded him to go. And he said, right, that's it. No more after that, right? So I left school at the end of the sixth one. But luckily, I'd got my UE and high school certificate. And which enabled me to go to university, which I didn't do in the start. I was in the Air Force for a year and then decided to go to university. Yeah. And got a really, when I think of some of the kids coming out of uni now and some of the people on your show, and I think, wow, those people, you know, they would have been straight A students, not here. straight C's right through to my final year. I started getting some reasonable sort of marks. But then ended up, you know, migrating back to Whanganui and did all sorts of jobs. I was a truck driver for a year. I worked in the forestry for a year. I had those odd jobs in like mowing lawns and cemetery and all of those sorts of things. And a mate of mine from uni had ended up on the oil fields up in Taranaki, and he rang me up one day and said, hey, we're looking for workers. Do you want to come up here and work? And one of the first wells I worked on was at McKee, and you know this, it's on Ngāti Maru Road. And yeah, so all of a sudden, I'm in this situation where I go, hey, you know what? I need to really think about, you know, what's happened up here and try and unpick some of that for myself just to learn about where I was from on that side. Yeah. That didn't come straight away because I actually started my own business, and that was extremely busy. And then progressed into banking and finance. And again, that was an odd break, if you like. It wasn't anything planned. It just sort of fell into my lap. But roll on to the CPT, which you'd remember when I first met you.
Yeah.
And learning about Daropatu and getting all of that fabulous history. If one of the great things that came out of the Waitangi Tribunal was this amount of resource put into the historical background to some of the claims, and Ngāti Maru was an incredible story.
Yeah,
it piqued my interest to end up going back to the Marae, and you know some of the names there. Anyhow, the CPT didn't quite work out, but I'll give a big shout out here to one of the young thrusters of the day that was there at the time. That's Holden Hohaia. And I have to say that he's a hero of mine because of the amount of effort and work that he actually put into from that period, just year in and year out, hard grind. And you know, I look at Anu and Nathan and the others and think, wow, you know, you guys really stepped up where I was kind of not willing to step up. And there were a number of reasons for that, because, as you know, that was a pretty rough and tumble period, that one. So, I ended up working in investments and finance and spent 25 or more years doing that. And, you know, used to come over to London and see you
Can I just jump in there, Mark? I'm just sort of trying to summarise quickly. I find it really interesting, your story, because, you know, I think what's quite common, I suppose, is the attitude of your father back then. I mean, it was a time when we weren't all encouraged to go to school. You know, there were good jobs back in those days where people could leave school straight away and get paid really well. And you can go into the freezing works, you can work in labouring jobs, and people had a decent way of life, you know, back then. So certainly can understand that people saw school as a waste of time back then. really interesting to see that you're encouraged by, you know, you had people supporting you from the school, perhaps, to look at another way. Just also, you know, the story about your mum or your parents encouraging you not to go to the marae, certainly not an unusual story. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons behind that. I mean, and the one that is often brought up is, you know, that, people just wanted us to get ahead because our elders had such a difficult time post-war, well, you know, from the wars back in the 1800s, really. It was a really difficult time for our people. So the way that they saw a way forward, and they were encouraged by society, I suppose, was to leave behind our culture. So again, you know, not an unusual story. Really good to see. I mean, not a lot of people were moving forward from there to go to university. So, you know, it's great to see that happen. And just coming into the space, or the Ngāti Māori space, you know, or touching on it, I suppose. And I just, again, just to recall what you were talking about back in the 90s, you know, we had our elders there. It was Uncle Pono and Uncle Mister and a lot of others trying to push through, well, not push through the claim, explore the claim at the time. And there was a lot of, you know, people weren't ready back then, you know, to go, to take it forward. So here we are about 25 years later at a point. So just, it takes a long time, and people, like, you know, you said Holden, just carrying it right through on a real steady basis, you know, to bring us to this point slowly, you know, it's incredible. So just tell us, how about getting into becoming a director? How did this happen?
Yeah, I was ran BNZ Investment Management, the investment management company, for a few years, and we were fortunate enough, I guess, to become fund manager of the year. And so I used to get the talking head interviews on TV. You know, they say, what do you think of the market today? Is it going up, going down? I never used to like that, because that's not the way you should invest, right? But they obviously wanted sound bites. And someone rang me up and said, hey, I really love what you're saying. You know, have you ever considered a role in director? I cannot remember who that was. But I said, no, I hadn't, but it'd be kind of interesting, I guess. And so I rang my boss at the time and said, look, I'm thinking about doing this director gig. I think it'd be quite interesting, make me a better investor, definitely. And anyhow, there was a lot of scrambling around at the office looking for a policy on that, which they didn't have. And the bank at the time, quite rightly, said no, because it could open all sorts of conflict issues. So I sort of parked that. Not long after that, though, a mate of mine had said he'd set up a startup which was just starting to really hit its growth straps, and he said, look, can you come over and look after that company for me while I go and build a business in Australia? And I said, yeah, I can do that, but I'd love to have a crack at this direct stuff. Which he said, yeah, that's all good. Pania Nathan Tyson, I bumped into her somewhere, and she said, look, you should just put your name down for the SOEs, right, and just start from there, which I did, and ended up at that time, even though I'd had my own company for many, many years, and so thought I knew a little bit about governance, but when you get up into large SOEs or public, it's a completely different game, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So anyway, I end up on the board of Transpower, and it just grew from there, where people were saying, hey, kind of like what you're doing, have you considered this, have you considered that? So it just sort of grew quite naturally.
Yeah.
And in the end, it got to a position where I was kind of turning down roles that I thought would be really good. I said to my mate, and the business had evolved since then when I'd started, I think there were 16 people when I decided to leave, there was 64. So it was a very fast growing startup and a very successful company as well. And said, look, I'd like to step back from the company and try my hand at full-time governance. And the timing was probably right for that. And just slowly picked up these roles, and have been extremely fortunate to get a broad base of roles and work with some incredibly talented people. And every one of those experiences is like a building block, right?
Yeah.
And I'm quite fortunate in that, you know, I keep notes. I'm pretty careful with how I arrange data and stuff like that, and so managed to keep some of those building blocks and build kind of a framework for myself that that has worked out really, really well. And sort of ended up, you know, on a few publicly listed companies. I've been chairing Infratil now for quite a few years and been on that board for 13 years or so. And just recently, my third time round with Ngaitahu, they've asked me to be the chair of Ngaitahu Holdings. And as you know, our relatives at Te Atiawa, through a company that I'm a shareholder and director in, who got a management contract for Atiawa, he said, "Look, really love you to consider coming onto the board of Atiawa." And I said, "Well, I think I might be conflicted, but you know, let me talk to the chairwoman there." And anyhow, so it's worked out, and I've ended up on that one as well. But through that process, Carl, you know, Australian and New Zealand companies had experience across the lot.
So just tell us a little bit about what I'm interested in is the sort of one, the type of work, I suppose, so, but without the detail. but more particularly the attributes of a good director, because obviously they keep saying, "Hey, Mark, you're doing great here. How about trying this one?" You know, what's an attribute of a good director?
You have to be able to recognise the difference between management and governance, firstly.
Yeah.
So
tell us about that.
Yeah. Well,
a lot of us have small companies, and we're sort of aware what it means to run a company as a director, which means you're managing and governing, really. Yeah. How do you break the two apart?
Yeah, so I went through all that. I went through that process as well, because I'd been had my own company. I was a director, and you don't call yourself chairman. I don't know whether you call yourself chairman of Hucklewood, but it's really ownership. There's quite a separation when you get up to companies with large number of people working in those companies, and there's tiering of the organisation. Essentially, the directors are there to protect the interests of the shareholders, and definitely to protect the act in the best interests of the company. Now, that might sound quite trite, and you know, people roll it out, but it's actually a real thing. And to do that, you can't manage the company. You can't be involved in the day-to-day activities. You have to step right back from that. And you're looking, you know, when I consider some of the things, that tools that I use, I'm always looking at trends. Trends are your friend when you're stepping right back from that. So you cannot be involved in the day-to-day management. And again, that if you do go too deep in it, all of a sudden you're putting yourself into conflict situations, right? You see this, and your management team are going to be in all sorts of pain because they're having to try and second guess an active member of the board or other directors. And so it's a really, really firm line that has to be taken, particularly by the chair, as to what comes to the governance table and what remains in the hands of management.
Right. Can you give us an example of how there might be conflicts? Or, I mean, what I'm thinking about the shareholder, you're acting in the shareholder's interests, I'm presuming financial. They want to protect their investment, and so there is a possibility that the management is so sort of engaged in looking after their people or self-interest that, you know, they could act in a way which is not necessarily aligned to the interests of the shareholders.
Yep, you just outlined it. I mean, that's exactly it. Where, you know, compensation is always a big one, right?
Yeah.
Because compensation essentially comes out of the shareholder's pocket
and
goes into the management pocket, right? So that's always an area of conflict.
Yeah.
I'll give you another example, actually, of conflict in respect of best interests of the company and best interests of the shareholders, because that's a subtle point that a lot of people don't get either. And that's around payment of dividends. So on the one hand, it's in the interests of shareholders to receive a dividend and a high dividend. But if you're putting a company at risk because you're taking cash out of the company and paying it in dividends, you have other stakeholders, i.e. banks and those other groups that Inland Revenue, that also have an interest and might have an earlier call. And so that's where you can get conflicts between the interests of the shareholder and the interests of the company.
Yeah.
So, in recognizing, you know, the important thing for a director is to recognize the subtleties around that. It's not always clear.
Yeah, and I suppose managing and communicating the tensions that are between different parties and getting them to appreciate that each has a particular, a valid view, but it's just managing the conversation to come out the right end.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, if you're not paying your staff the appropriate remuneration, you might lose them. And that's a risk for the company, right? That can be a risk for the company. So you're juggling these risks. But on the other side of that, overpaying management is like taking money from the shareholders and giving it to somebody else. So that's a risk that has to be managed, you know, with the owners. So it's a balancing act. These things are never really, really clear cut. And that's what the board's role, or part of the board's role, is to work their way through those sorts of sorts of issues.
I can imagine there's huge potential for conflict and tension. And so while you've got your technical skills in terms of understanding, you know, data and finance and trends, and coming back to attributes, I remember one of the things I remember from law school, I can't remember a lot, but one of them was, the role a person has in their family growing up tends to be the role that they have on a board. And so often it's the firstborn children who are on board because I suppose they're just given the time and the mana to be able to express their point of view. I'm trying to understand what's a good attribute for a director, you know.
Well, it's interesting you say that about the firstborn, because I am the firstborn, yeah. Just an interesting anecdote. When my eldest, my daughter, you've met,
you know,
her birthday fell in the June, right? And so that meant that in the New Zealand education system, you could put her up a year or down a year. And so as young parents, you know, we're kind of the teacher. She looks, she's bright enough to go up a year. And going, oh yeah, brilliant. That's good to hear. And the headmaster said, nah, but I wouldn't advise it. I said, why is that? And he said, because Renee will get far more leadership opportunities if she's the oldest in the class. Because if she's bright, which she was bright, if she's bright and she's the oldest, kids at 5, 6, 7, 8, they always look up to the oldest. And she got these wonderful, wonderful leadership opportunities, and it's carried through, you know, to now.
Yeah.
So I think there is something in the oldest. There's no doubt about that. But I think, you know, your education and your life experiences can prepare you for those sorts of roles, at least as much. And you know, if I'm looking at the board, so I chair a board, and everyone says, well, you know, you're obviously leading that board. I don't view it that way at boards. I view boards very much as a collection of equals. And when people say you're a leader, that automatically assumes that there are followers.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of the directors that I work with would say, yeah, I'm following you, Mark. You know, everything's contestable. And it's really that part is about you as a director wanting to offer the best that you can with your experience applied to problems faced by companies and boards, and the chairman eliciting the best out of those people. And so it's as much a facilitation role. It's not what I would call a leadership role. I don't really buy into that. I think if you're on a board, you know, you're not there to follow. You're there to offer the experience that you've got to address problems that are raised, you know, be it commercial, be it values, be it reputational, all of those things.
Okay. All right. I can see how, as a chair, it's more about collaboration, working together, trying to come up with a solution that is fit for the company.
Yeah, it's really about getting the best out of the experience, because the directors I work with are vastly experienced in many, many fields.
Yeah.
And so you end up, if you think about it, you know, problems that businesses face or questions that will come have to be guiding management around, that having a multidisciplinary approach to a problem is far, far better than me saying, oh, I think the answer is this, right? So you're drawing on all these experiences, and everybody has a different framework that they work to. Everyone has different experiences. And so applying all of those to a problem, you get a far, far better result. No doubt. No doubt at all.
So, Mark, tell me, you've been at this game for a while now. There wouldn't have been many Māori on board when you started. Are there more coming through? I'm talking, and women as well is the other one. You know, there are more coming through these days. How's it panning out?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to be fair, the way back in, I think it was the Labor government in the 1980s, where they definitely pushed for diversity on the board. So they created SOEs, which hitherto were run by, you know, the same old, really. And as that was unbundled and more market-orientated policies were introduced, and these companies were opened up to market forces, so they had to meet, you know, the needs of their customers, you needed boards. And one of the things that they identified really early on is diversity was a good thing. And I firmly believe that, right? There's no doubt. There's no doubt in my mind that diversity is a great thing. So it wasn't quota by any stretch of the imagination, but there were more women coming on board. And there were, at the start, you know, some Māoris coming through, not a lot. And I look at it, I look across now and think, wow, you know, we've really stepped up. But in part of that, I think that's in lockstep with Māori commercial development. Yeah. So the type of skills that you need on a board, right? I've said to many, many people that if you can't understand a set of financials, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to be successful on a board. And so in lockstep with the success of Māori commercial activity, we've seen more and more Māori coming through on boards, and that's been a absolutely great thing. I'll give you a little story, though, Carl, a funny story, right? So in the public, in the listed market, a lot of the shares are owned by passive funds and international passive funds. Yeah. And because they're such large funds, New Zealand accounts for a tiny, tiny proportion of these funds. And so when you're at annual general meetings and you have to pass shareholders' resolutions, often these big passive funds will appoint what's called a proxy advisor. So they're an outfit that handles all of that for these smaller shareholdings. And I had one where you'll laugh, but I got penalised as chairman for my board not being diverse enough. And I was probably the only Māori chairman of a publicly listed company. I was kind of like, what the? And that goes to the view of what diversity really means, right? I was gobsmacked when I got it's on record, you know, it's on record. So I was laughing to myself, and I never got a chance at the AGM to put it out there, you know, so isn't this ironic, you know. I think it's a fabulous thing, and I look at some of the really, really talented young Māori women directors, and I look at the role that women are playing in Māori organisations, and I'm all for it. I just think it's absolutely fantastic. I bring another completely different sort of approach to some of the things. When I was starting in the CPT in the 1990s, that wasn't very common, right?
It's really interesting how that's moved on and changed, and it's just hard to imagine, you know. Well, soon it's going to be hard to imagine that it was any different any other way, because there's so much talent that has been denied to us until now, you know.
So Mark, it's like climate change, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, climate change, although I'm old enough to remember acid rain, that was really the sort of a climate issue back in the 1970s and 1980s, and we worked our way through that, but it sort of became normal, and now we've got a, you know, climate change has become part and parcel of risk management in any commercial organisation.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, you're chair of Ngāi Tahu and Te Atiawa Holdings, as you were saying. How is it different being a director on those boards compared to being a director of a public listed board? And does it create different expectations for you?
Yeah, it's interesting to say that. So I started out, you know, part of my journey, and I've been so fortunate with the number of people that I've worked with, started out with a Tūwhare Titan Corporation, Lake Taupo Forest Trust. A big shout out to Tim Hall on this, because he was the guy that came and saw me. And Rangi Downs, actually a wonderful, wonderful kaumātua, Tūwhare Titan kaumātua, came and saw me one day in my office when I was busy managing BNZ Investment Management. And they had this idea, this germ of an idea, to start a Māori investment company. And myself, Adrian Orr, who was from Taupo, who some of you might know, Adrian was there as well at the start. Alan Haronga was there at the start. And that was kind of my first introduction to governance. And we were more like executive governors at that stage, though, but governance in Māori organisations. And Tim and I and Adrian and Alan worked on that business for many, many years. And I got a really good grounding, I think, in corporation and trust commercial entities. And let's face it, Carl, I wasn't there because of my cultural expertise by any stretch of the imagination, but did bring, I suppose, a commercial point of view. And working with Tim and Alan, but particularly with Tim, he was tremendous in terms of awakening, if you like, a notion about how we should operate Māori businesses. Now, I have to also mention here my nan, who was the one that said, "Look, we're going to park you and your whānau are going to go to through the state school system, well, not state, but you're going to go completely through the European system, and we're going to keep you away from the marae." I rang her when Rangi and Tim came and saw me and said, "Hey, I've just had this meeting with these two guys from Tūwhare Toa. What do you make of that? How do you think I should think about that?" She was absolutely fantastic. She said, "Now is the time to pay the piper. You were sort of not ring fenced, that's not her words, but you were put in this position, and now you have to put something back. This is your chance to put something back." So I don't know whether she planned that over a period of 30 years or more, but it was kind of a really cool, and that got me, I suppose, interested to help. And funnily enough, I whakapapa into Lake Taupo Forest Trust anyhow, and so, you know, it was actually helping her and our whānau anyhow. But very, very interesting experience. And if you ask me, are they different? From my perspective, what they wanted from me was actually no different to what anyone wanted from me on any board that I've ever been on, which, you know, so that was easy, I suppose, for me, because it meant I didn't have to go and learn a whole bunch of new stuff. Yeah. But you know, the organisations I work with wanted the same as any other organisation wants. They want to be successful. Yeah. And they want to be successful on their own terms as well. And they want to be successful commercially, but they want to be successful within a value set that they promulgate. Now, the interesting thing about those value sets, every trust and incorporation slightly different. You know, so you talk to the dairy farmers around Lake Taupo, quite different view of the world, say, to the forest, the foresters around the lake. And interestingly enough, one of the things that we had to make a decision on while I was there, and it was a fantastic learning experience for me, was, I don't know if you remember, an outfit called Crafer Farms had a terrible terrible reputation for herd treatment and environmental impact and all the rest of this sort of thing. Well, when that model was in its heyday, We were getting banks approaching us to say, if you convert some of your forest to dairy farms, look at this payoff profile. And it was really interesting that the wise Kaumātua and Wahine and Tūwhiritoa, particularly around the Lake Taupo and the Forest Trust, said, you know what, the long game here is the protection of the lake, right? That's the long game, so we're not going to play the short game. So we didn't do any of those conversions at all. Wow. And, you know, I think that was the, you know, when you look at where we are now, 20 years on, 20, 25 years on, it was the right decision, you know, all the issues with nitrates and all the rest of that. So there's a value set there that is not necessarily about making dollars the quickest and easiest way you possibly can. They want to be commercially successful, but they want to be commercially successful in their own terms and with their own value set. And the difference I have found between Māori organisations and some of the other organisations I work for is the long game. They're willing to play the long game. You know, you talked about Holden earlier and said, oh, he's been beavering away with Maru for 25 years. That's a generation he's been doing that, right? Mm. It's a whole generation. When you think about it, it's a whole generation.
Yeah.
And I think that is for me, the one difference, and that's a tremendous advantage, an absolutely tremendous advantage, because the long game is better than the short game.
Yeah, okay. So just going back to attributes we were talking about prior, and you were saying, you know, what you bring, you apply those attributes across the board. It doesn't matter what type of organisation it is, whether it's Māori owned or public, but it's the framework that you operate within is different, or the value system can be a bit different. And interesting. Well, I suppose in terms of the long game, it's about, this is where all those values come in terms of whakapapa and legacy and leaving it for children and kaitiakitanga and you know, people are willing to make a sacrifice for immediate gain for themselves because they want something that's ongoing beyond just themselves, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a balance there, though, Carl. You know, sometimes I've sat in hui and gone, you know what? You're using the long game argument for today's underperformance. And what do I mean by that? Sometimes if an organization is or a commercial operation or an operating company, let's call it an operating company, is underperforming, sometimes I've seen, oh, well, we're playing the long game here, so it's for our grandchildren, which comment really tugs at the heartstrings of many of the stakeholders, right? But often, you know, and I have been the person to call that out at times and got no friends because of it. But, you know, I just have to call that out, right, and say, look, you know, actually there's serious underperformance here, and you can't use the long game as an excuse because it doesn't actually reconcile with what you should be looking at in terms of the long game. That's in the, I have to say, though, that is in the minority, right? So yeah. I guess my job is to peel back that argument and say, well, you know, this is the way I see it, and I'll just call it the way I see it. And I think that's what people appreciate, right? But, you know, you go, the interesting thing about the Tūwhiritoa discussion and the conversions of the Forest Trust, you're sitting there at the time going, wow, that's a big cool opportunity cost. But the way that was, I suppose, discussed and the manner of the decision making, I was completely, you bang on the money.
I want to talk about that a bit more because we've all been to hui, and there's often, I mean, beautiful orators, you know, when they stand up and they engage all the emotions and, you know, really pull on the heartstrings, and you get swayed so easily. And our people are so good at that. It must be difficult to, but you, as a director, I suppose your role is also to have a rational mind as well and look at, because like you say, sometimes it might be just underperformance and it's nothing to do with the long term. It's just how they're operating the business. So you've got to be able to stand up and pull them back
So I suppose this is where not being able to speak to Rao is actually an advantage, right? Because with the long oratory into, apologizing for performance or something like that, it actually doesn't it can't resonate with me because I actually can't understand what people are saying. And so it's kind of like, well, let's just get back to, and I suspect that that's really rubbed people up the wrong way, right? Because they see it as culturally offensive. And I think you have to be a little bit, I have to be careful with it myself. But I think other people have to be really careful as well in that they use culture as a weapon, right? And I think that's a really, really dangerous, place to go.
Yeah, it's a really interesting place to navigate, Mark. It's intriguing.
Yeah.
Just looking at Māori and, our aspirations for the future, and we talk about the long game and also the different values that we bring in. Do you think the corporate model is still the best model that we can use, or is there something else we should be looking at, or is there some way we should be able to manage our or change the structure so that we can be more aligned with what we're doing?
The market, for want of a better word, the political, economic, commercial regime that we operate in is going to be very, very difficult to change. And having said that, funnily enough, I think if you look at the corporate world, it's up to really Māori to influence the corporate world. And we know that that's actually happening. So Māori ESG principles, which are really, standard for Māori organizations, are weaving their way into normal corporate speak now, when we think about it. And, we've been through a tremendously difficult period, as an example, with Ngāi Tahu, in that with the COVID and the government response to COVID, we had a tourism business that went from revenues, in the multi-millions to zero overnight. Yeah. Now, as a result of that, we were forced to shutter, to hibernate, many of the businesses because they're totally reliant on international tourists, and made hundreds, if you like, redundant. Now, those are really, really hard calls. But I'd like to think that in doing that, we stuck with values and principles that ensured our behaviour was absolutely exemplary through that process. And that comes down to, if you're a Māori business, you have to behave, at the very, very top end of the values range and live those.
Yeah.
Because it's all too easy for people to pick off Māori businesses on a nonsense reputational issue, right? Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
and people absolutely love doing that. I hear it all the time and think, oh my God, I'm tired of arguing it, to be honest, because those sorts of views are just rampant, they're rampant. They're the flat earthers and, man hasn't been on the moon type people, right?
All right. I was just trying to think what I was going
to
say.
Well, coming back to the corporate, is there another way?
Also, just want to jump in again. Because I see that, just want to go back to your point where you talk about the influence that Māori culture has on broader society, and we see it from here as well. And I'm just thinking about Jacinda Ardern and the influence that she's had. And I just think the openness of New Zealand society and the embracing of difference. I mean, it's changed over time, but I think Māori culture has really had a big part to play in that. And I'm just wondering, with your international experience, do you see the filtering of, is there value in these ideas for organisations outside of New Zealand?
Well, you're an example of that. I should ask you that question, right? Because that's your whole business.
Yeah.
If I look at particularly Māori exporters, right? And the point of difference for Māori exporters. Now, is it real or is it not? I'm not so certain that there's I'm not quite so certain that there's, if you like, a direct monetary a direct monetary benefit. But if you are sending your products with your branding, there's a bit of your culture that goes with it, right?
Yeah.
That is going to the China or going to the UK or going wherever. And I think that is really important, in that you're keeping a uniqueness and an authenticity that might resonate with your customers. And I mean, that's kind of your business as well, right? I mean, a lot of it's interesting to me that Maori, in terms of colonized indigenous people, have done really, really well in this space. But when we say, you know, indigenous people, right, I think we have to be a little bit careful. My wife's family, they're all immigrant family from the Netherlands, right? You could say that, and you know this because you do work over there, they're indigenous.
Yeah,
is incredibly strong and implanted on a number of the things that they export around the world. And if you want, probably the biggest example of this would probably be would be the US and the media, how their culture has impacted the media so much, right? You know, that's through movie, film, social media, all the rest of that sort of carry on. Look at the way we dress and behave. Yeah. Sometimes it's very heavily influenced by so-called American culture as well.
Yeah. I just think well, when I look at the problems around the world, and I think of climate change, and I think how we treat each other, how we treat the environment, how there's a huge emphasis on profit, which is to the detriment of communities and the environment, I just think there may be other answers to these problems. And I think maybe Māori have those answers in terms of the values that we have and the process that we're going through now of running our organizations within these frameworks where these values become are important. So the emphasis on the financial bottom line is still there, but it's not it needs to be balanced with other and the values as well. And I see that with Māori organizations, and I suppose I'm just interested in how you balance that as a director, and also just whether or not there's any value in that for organizations outside of New Zealand.
I think that's, it's interesting. I think that's happening. If you're operating Māori businesses, you are definitely thinking intergenerational. So I'm very fond of saying, for Māori businesses like Ngāi Tahu o Te Ateawa, we are thinking 100 years out. And that is because we will be here in 1,000 years' time in Aotearoa, right? We'll be here in 1,000 years' time. So we can break that 1,000 years down to 10 lots of 100. And then we can break that 10 lots of 100 down to 10 lots of 10. And that's the way that I view it. And so when you say the financial bottom line, all of the things you're talking about, environment, sustainability, they go directly to the bottom line. And it may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, it may not be the next day, but in 20 years' time, you know that it's going to go to the bottom line. You know, that's the thing about the long game. And so if we've got one super, super advantage here, it is that we're, and, you know, whilst I said, you know, people will make sometimes the under the guise of a sacrifice for our grandchildren, there's poor performance. Actually, having people willing to do that is a tremendous, tremendous competitive advantage to getting both the commercial and the environmental and the cultural results that you want.
Yeah.
But you have to be willing to play the long game and think about it in terms of the long game, right?
Yeah. And when I mean, the hard bit is when I think of American culture, and we do a lot of work in the US, and I really enjoy it because their enthusiasm and their support for business. But they don't think the long term. They think they just want to make money as quickly as possible, you know, for themselves. You know, that's the culture there, and that's perfectly acceptable over there. I just think that sort of attitude now probably needs to start to change, because, you know, the impact of that has been, you know, to the detriment of the environment and people as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you look at China's normally the poster child for those sorts of things that you're talking about, but I have incredible respect for what's been achieved. And America had a big role in this, actually, what's been achieved in China. When you think of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of people being brought out of poverty, yep. if you think on a global scale, right, hundreds of people being brought out of poverty, and the impact of that on the planet, there's a scale. I'm trying to think of what it is. When per capita incomes reach a certain level, there's a positive effect on the environment, because those things, you know, you bring those down. So if you're thinking about people burning wood to cook, and all the health issues and the environmental issues with that, bringing people out of poverty, it's just been absolutely phenomenal in the last 20 or 30 years. And I think it's too, you know, there's a balancing act between that and impacts on the environment. And I'm an absolute optimist about the environment and the impact we're having on the environment, in that I'm involved in the renewable energy industry, and I can just see that it's markets and cost curves that will drive down and have driven down the cost of renewable energy, which then will displace oil. You know, and there's no doubt that that's that's actually going to happen. Yeah. And I'm of the view that one of the reasons maybe Saudi Arabia were looking at selling part of Aramco, one of the largest companies in the world, was because they've seen their future, and it's probably better to get as much oil out of the ground now. You know, it used to be you could hold on to it, so-called peak oil, but if you look at the cost curves for renewable energy at the moment, particularly solar, it's just inevitable, I think, that what will happen is that'll be displaced.
Mm. Okay. So you still, I mean, despite the values argument, the efficiency of running a good economy and good businesses is still really important.
Well, overlaid with the values, Carl, you can't separate the two. If you're trying to paint me into a corner here, you can't really do that, because the values are over the top of every behaviour and every decision that's made commercially, right? And so if you haven't got those right, you're not going to be successful, I don't think, personally. Yeah. If you're just out to make money for yourself, sooner or later you're going to, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword, right?
No, good. And I think it's good to be reminded of that, because, you know, we sometimes talk in extremes when you talk about the bottom line is financial. And, I mean, no company's going to run their – well, some do, actually. But, the vast majority are always organising them. They work with people. So there's values that need to be taken into account of. And you've got to operate within a certain framework of values, even though, we're measuring finances at the end of the day.
Yeah, but finance is only one measure, right?
Yeah.
So if you haven't got happy customers, your finances disappear. If you haven't got happy employees, your finances disappear. If you're not caring for the environment, your finances disappear. I mean, you know, they're all actually interlinked. And if you take the long game, particularly with the environment, if there's no environment, you ain't got a long game.
Yeah, good. I think that's really important, because, you know, just for people who are willing to go into positions like yourself, they're not positions of extreme. You know, we've got the skills and the value set amongst ourselves to be able to be successful as directors on board.
Yeah, so, I've been really, really lucky. I don't know whether that was the case, but I was one of the very early Māori directors, so what happened is roles opened up for me. I don't know whether people were filling quotas or whatever, but roles seem to open up. It's probably harder. It's probably harder for people now, because I'm not especially clever. But I've ended up with all of these wonderful experiences and working with some absolutely brilliant people, and managed to hold on to little fragments of these experiences that I can add to a conversation. now.
All right. Hey, just a couple more things. One is more about that. Well, we'll start with Ngāti Maru first. And I just want to raise Ngāti Maru as an example, because we're not all from Ngāti Maru, of course. But Ngāti Maru's just, not completed a settlement. They're at a stage where the people have ratified the settlement. And we're going to get about 30 million plus a bit more. it always creates a sort of bit of tension when we when this money comes in, you know, because it's all of a sudden, you know, we've gone from poverty for 150 years to having a bunch of money in the bank. And, you know, we've got our own commercial directors on board. But just as an example, how do you sort of manage the fear that our people have, and what are the steps that you'd take to, I suppose, prosper, be successful?
So you have to earn that trust, right? It doesn't come. It doesn't come on day one. I think you have to set up exemplary governance structures where everyone feels that they've got a say in that. I think you cannot underestimate the amount of communication that's required to step everyone through what your strategic plan is and what you, you know, what does good look like, right? So, and that will take years. It's not gonna be there's no silver bullet on that, and you have to earn that respect. So automatically you end up with quite conservative portfolios. But you may know this, but I've been huge with my role with Koau and Aotearoa pushing for Maru to be included in some of the deals that we had going pre-settlement. So and you know, everyone was very happy to support Maru into that, because I think some of those are absolutely fantastic deals. I think Maori settlement entities have a really wonderful opportunity. But let's face it, the partnership is with the Crown. Yeah, that, so we are now enshrined, or will be, in a particular set of legislation that outlines our partnership with the Crown. And if there's two things I know, one of them is the Crown will still be here in 1,000 years' time, and the other is that Ngāti Maru will still be here in 1,000 years' time. So that's a wonderful opportunity to work with that partnership for Maru to put to work to their commercial advantage the capital that they've had and the talented resources that you've got, that we've got in terms of people as well. So whilst the Maru settlement in the scheme of things is quite small, per capita it's actually quite large, but that's because the Maru's haven't bothered filling out their forms, right? So per capita it's quite large. But if you have those governance structures and management structures, and I'll come back to management structure, I'll just address that now. It has to be fit for purpose, and by that I mean it has to be, in terms of cost structure, relatively tight and low, right? You can't have a big cost structure, because any earnings you make off $30 million in a 0.1% risk-free rate, interest rate environment, it's gone. It's gone with one employee, right? So you have to be very, very careful about your cost structures. So you have to show through that a behavior that will resonate with whānau so that they trust the decisions that are being made. Now, automatically it pushes you into a more conservative space. Because the last thing you want to do in the first 5 years is rock up to the hui a iwi and go, oh, sorry, everybody, we dropped $10 million. You know,
Which has happened.
What's that?
Which has happened, not with Ngāti Maru, of course, with other tribes.
Yeah. We can't mention who it's happened to, Carl.
Sure.
That would be gloating. Anyhow. So you end up being quite conservative, but within that conservative, I guess, mindset, thinking about the partnership with the Crown, there are DSP properties, but there are also partnerships with other iwi in the region, and there are also opportunities to partner up with our iwi across New Zealand, and there's some wonderful opportunities to be had across that, because as these DSPs and RFRs and that are exercised, I would love to think that there's room for Maru to play in these asset purchases that are in effect backed by either a government sale or a government income stream, right? And you couldn't get more conservative than that. And that might look like they might look risky, but actually, you know, when you think about the New Plymouth Police Station and New Plymouth Courthouse, the lease, and it has actually very, very low, very, very low risk, right? Yeah. So I think there are opportunities there, but it's going to take a bit of work. And through that period, you've got the situation where you can't let your cost structures blow out while you're trying to put all this together, right? And so it's a balancing act. But you got some wonderful, you know, I watched Jamie's your Jamie's podcast with Huckleworks, and I thought that was really good. And you know, he's fantastic, right?
Yeah. And some great people coming through as well. And one of them's on here is Tamsin Rose.
Tamsin, yeah.
But when you talk about the importance of communication, I mean, she's been one of the stalwarts in terms of, you know, being connected back to the whānau, being connected back to the people back at Waitara and Taranaki and other places, and just having, you know, I suppose I can't agree more with what you're saying. It's about trust and communication, and I think it's taken us 25 years to get from the last attempt to here, and that's all about people taking their time and doing it properly. So just mihi to everybody who's involved in that. Just one last question, Mark, and I suppose it's for people maybe like Tamsin or anybody from the whānau who, you know, you can just see the potential that they have in terms of the values that they carry. I suppose the difficult thing for a lot of our people is that the financial aspect is not that interesting. But just what would you advise to people who are interested in becoming a director on companies? How would we go about doing it?
I would say never underestimate luck. There's a certain luck element to it. There's definitely a network element, and with a number of Māori directors in New Zealand now, that network is growing for people. I think there's a certain level of skill and experience you need, otherwise you will flounder. And it's an environment where particularly the boards I'm on, you are expected to deliver, and if you're not delivering, it will come out in a review or whatever. So starting out can be really, really difficult. I think a really nice route for people who are looking at governance and wondering whether it's the right thing for them is through the SOE, and it used to be Crown Monitoring Authority, but the SOE process and hiring, getting directors through that process. And sort of that's how I came to be, I suppose, on a couple of the SOE. Well, it was how I came to be on the SOE boards. And I was kind of hired a little bit because I had particular skills in investment and finance, which were in those days, particularly around treasury operations, because I'd spent 25 years working in that environment. Those days were relatively unknown skills. So I had a skill that was in demand at that particular time. So I was very, very lucky. Now, I have a saying, Carl, I think I probably said it to you, better to be lucky than good. And so the timing in that respect, I had the technical skills. And I actually had the time as well to put in to the boards. That's really important. You've got to have time and really work at these things. I don't know how people with 8 or 9 boards actually do it. I've got 4, operating company boards that I'm on, and that's a full-time job, right? At the moment, actually, it's a little bit more than a full-time job. So you actually have to have the time. So there's a luck component. There's a network component. There's a technical component, and then if you're lucky enough, for argument's sake, to have big data, AI skills in those areas, boards are kind of venture cap, you know, the sort of early stage venture capital investment mindset, deep experience in health, safety, environmental, those sorts of skills are at the moment in really, really high demand. And I was just lucky when I came through that the skills that I had at the time, which were more treasury based and risk management based, that they were in high demand as well. But I do recommend, so I'm going back 20 years or more now, I do recommend, it was a fabulous experience for me getting on a couple of state-owned enterprise boards and working with, working with people who were wanting to put something back at the time, because it wasn't particularly remunerative. That's the other thing, don't go into this thinking that it's you're going to make your millions, because you don't. This is as much about an intellectual challenge and building up an experience base and learning. So I'm getting huge amounts out of that, just because of the people that I'm managing to work with, the way they make decisions and the experience, their life experiences, their work experiences, what they bring through. It's just absolutely joy.
Kapai. Hey, Mark, just want to say thank you. And just as a final mihi, just ka hokinga mahara ki ngā tūpuna, ko tēnei tā rā o Parihaka. So this is the day of Parihaka, November the 5th, I think, I can't remember exact year, I think it was 1888, where the Parihaka was invaded by the constabulary. I'm pretty sure your ancestors were there as well, and it's funny, I thought of your ancestor last night, Te Mana o Paiho Tume, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was thinking of him last night, actually, and because he would have been around at that particular time as well. So,
yeah, he was my great, my mana was my grandfather's father.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Yeah, so just thinking of them and Tamsin just reminded me it's 1881, and just the difficult time that they went through. I mean, that's part of the Ngāti Maru claim. Mainly just remind me of the work that Anaru's done as well in terms of the great communication, bringing the iwi forward in the last 5 years or so. But really lovely to have you on talking to us, and it's been really valuable for me and hopefully for other people as well. And so just tell us, what's your plans for the rest of the time in New Zealand? Are you back there for a long time, or is it just...
It's going to be at least 3 months because of the rules. I actually have a really heavy workload coming up over the next couple of months, and my face-to-face boards back in Australia don't really start. Globally, face-to-face meetings are still a bit hit and miss, right? So we're doing them all over Zoom and all the rest of that sort of carry on. So I haven't really got any reason to go back to Australia until that cycle starts up again, and who knows whether the bubble will be here or not. But this year was kind of going to be a big travel year for me. I think I had five long-haul trips in my calendar, one of those to Argentina to go up to Mendoza. I don't know whether you've been up there, Carl, or done any work up there.
No.
Yeah, but that's all. That's all disappeared at the moment, so it's nose to the grindstone, really.
Yeah, it's been really difficult with lockdown, but at the same time, I think good time. We're coming into winter now. We're in second lockdown. It's nice to be with whānau and have a time to be together and contemplate moving forward. So, ka pai, ko mutu tō tātanei mahi tēnei wā. Thanks for coming on, and kia ora tātou. Thank you for everyone.
Hey, you need to go and get some sleep, bro.